Okay, so please continue about
the chicken project we had. We had Rhode Island aired chickens. We supported them in wire cages and had the supplement feed flown in.
Uh-huh.
But what we were doing is crossbreeding the Rhode Island Red with the local chickens. The Rhode Island Reds themselves could not hack it in the local environment as far as disease or the food supply. But we found that the crossbred chick would be able to survive the local disease environment but still have a better egg and meat production. So the villagers would bring us their eggs, which we would eat for breakfast, and we would give them, on a one-to-one basis, fertilized eggs from our crossbreeds that they could put under their setting hens, and they would hatch these out. So that was one of our livestock projects. You want to hear about jam?
Sure. No, I think this is actually a good joke on a couple of levels.
Jim Archer had also gone down to Bangkok and gotten a boar pig they raised.
This is your predecessor.
My predecessor, Hong Sa. Jim left, and I inherited his menagerie of animals. And at that point, the boar pig got up to service age. And so I would loan the pig out to farmers and let them breed their sows. And here again, the crossbred pigs would have a better production, yet be able to survive the local environment. So my monthly report that went through the different levels of aid, since we were subcontracted to Agency for International Development, I had a phrase in there that jam is at the far end of the valley, contributing to the genetic pool of the local swine population.
And this is J-A-M.
J-A-M.
Like jam that you might have on your toast.
That's right. And Jim had named all the animals. And so I was just following through with his names. Well, shortly after that, Jim Malia, the associate chief of party, made an unscheduled visit. And being remote as we were, I knew something was up. And he had to stay overnight to get a plane out the next day. And that evening, he finally got around to it, he said, well, Ken, I think it'd be best if you wouldn't mention the name of your animals in your monthly reports. Whereupon I looked at him and said, well, why not? Jim then looked at me and says, you don't know, do you? I don't know what. He says, JAM stands for Joseph A. Mendenhall, Chief of Mission. And it turns out that all the second echelon bureaucrats down in Vientiane would call Joseph A. Mendenhall Jam behind his back. And so they read the monthly report that this IVS reporting his boss was screwing the hogs up in Hong Sa Valley. They were rolling in the floors, and that monthly report probably got reproduced and passed around more than any other report in Laos. So I complied, and I did not refer to the name of the animals, not knowing what other people that Jim was referring to and his names that he had given out. I do know that the one dog was called Colonel Hafner. I never mentioned that in the monthly report. So
yeah,
I never
knew that one already.
I knew that one already. So,
but the three initials, that would be a little more difficult to decipher. So that was done in innocence.
my mention our rabbits. We had some rabbits. Didn't do a whole lot in the village level with those, but we had them for our own use. And I noticed something a little strange that I didn't have to clean the rabbit pens out. They seemed to always be self-cleaning.
Uh-huh.
And I was at the Mun Nan.
Well, they're not. So what's
Mun Nan at the far end of the valley one day, and I found out. Lau Lau was a local Lau Moonshine whiskey. Uh-huh. And when they brought the Lau Lau out that day, I saw in the bottom of the bottle floating some of my rabbit turds.
Uh-huh.
And they apparently thought the rabbit turds in the Lau Lau would give you strength or virility or whatever.
Ooh.
It was a little disconcerting to be served Lau Lau from such a bottle, but I knew from the composition of Lau Lau that it was probably strong enough to kill any pathogens or any bacteria, so I went ahead and drank it anyway.
Did it help the taste?
I don't know. Lala, you couldn't taste anything anyway.
Well, it was just alcohol?
Yes.
Yeah, just, yeah.
You
probably
put a match to
pure.
It, it would blow, it would flame right up.
Oh, we had some stuff like that in the Philippines,
it was,
too.
It was strong stuff.
Yeah, yeah. So, but, you know, this, you did mention something kind of interesting, and in your story about Jam the Pig, all of your monthly reports are passed along through the AID organization. Did you have any qualms about that? The fact that here's the IVS organization, which is non-governmental, and yet you're writing monthly reports that are distributed throughout the AID system.
Well, I think that pointed up some of the tensions we had in IVS. On the one hand, yes, we were a private organization, we were mm-hmm. non-governmental, but our contract was with a government agency.
Mm-hmm.
And we were, our support, material support, air support and such, came through aid and not necessarily mm-hmm. IVS. At the same time, we were very idealistic volunteers, just most of us out of college. And many of us were in opposition to the prevailing government policy in Southeast Asia. So that did create a very definite tension of relationship to IVS to aid. And of course, we were reminded every month when we filled our monthly report that they were paying our bill.
Mm-hmm. It's, was the jerk on the chain.
Yes, even though since we weren't aid and part of their career advancement, that jerk wasn't quite as strong as aid would like.
Right, right.
And I know it was a difficult thing for aid many times because they viewed us as their agents out there on their payroll
mm-hmm.
To do what they needed to be done. And their priorities were not always the same as IVS.
Right.
And especially the individual volunteer.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose in retrospect, given that situation, maybe it's amazing that we got away with what we did.
You got away with, what do you mean?
With that we could function and as independently as we did.
Okay.
And and we could criticize and such without serious repercussions. We had an incident of a truck military, well, let me back up. It was a situation where I was ready to make a trip mm-hmm. to the far end of the valley, and I kept getting interrupted that morning, and I was so frustrated, and it was like 2 hours after I was planning on leaving, I finally got around to leaving,
mm-hmm.
and we always had to check with the local military before we made trips the other end of the valley, because sometimes they'd send an escort with us. So I sent Udomo over to check with the colonel, and he came back and said, no, you can't go. There's been a landmine explosion.
Ooh.
Well, it turned out the military had the only other vehicle in the valley. Their truck had hit a landmine.
Uh-huh.
And to this day, we don't know for sure but what that landmine wasn't set for us to hit. But I had gotten delayed, and so I'm very thankful for the villagers that aggravated me and delayed me that day. Bill Sage happened to be up there on visiting part of his orientation that day. And so I called, the military truck came back and they had two or three severely injured soldiers.
Uh-huh.
And there was a big ceremony going in along Prabang that day and a lot of helicopters tied up, carrying big shots around. And I called up Mr. Perry, who was the area coordinator and very high up in aid about a helicopter, and I wasn't getting any. I called him again on the radio and got a hold of him, and I remember that I was getting very frustrated, and I told him, I know where the helicopter's at, we need one, you better start kicking some ass and get me a helicopter,
mm-hmm.
get this guy out. And Tom Tuff says, you can't talk to Mr. Perry like that, you are really going to get called in the carpet for that. And it never happened. I never got a reprimand for that. I relate that because I think it gave, it was a little bit of the quasi-independence that we had as IVSers. Yes, we did get away with a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, he knew I was probably right. That I knew that the chopper's being used for ceremonial purposes.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a situation we felt was very important to be addressed.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, injured people.
These injured people and probably injured in our place.
Yeah.
And we felt a very, very big obligation to them.
Mm-hmm.
And just like with the irrigation person, if you'd been in a normal, if I'd have been in a normal aid channels, he'd have found some way to make my life very miserable, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But we were somewhat independent in that way.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure it was hard for a lot of the aid people to to deal with at times,
put up with these young whippersnappers.
Young whippersnappers out here, you know.
Think they know what they're doing.
Yeah, and, you know, we were, let's face it, we were pretty pretty aggressive, idealistic. When none of us were wallflowers, you wouldn't be there if you were wallflowers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We were believed in what we were doing. You had to believe in what you're doing if you're willing to take those kind of risks.
To continue with these monthly reports, this is one aspect of it. Another question about you in the monthly reports. This has to do with the way in which many different organizations who were in Laos all seem to be interconnected. That is to say, AID might be sharing information with other agencies,
mm-hmm.
Which could be sensitive. Did you ever have a feeling, suspicion, or even knowledge that information that you were writing in a monthly report might have been passed on to some other agency?
Oh, yes. There was really not a clear distinction between the various agencies
mm-hmm.
that were functioning in Laos, whether it was aid, military attachés, CIA,
mm-hmm.
IVS, whatever. Those lines were very blurred, especially in the field.
Yeah.
They might have been...
Yeah, that's in the field, but even in Vientiane.
And in Vientiane, it was very much a sharing mm-hmm. among that information, and we knew that. It was... the mission was actually relatively small.
Mm-hmm.
And it was small enough that everyone felt part of the whole group, even though each agency had their own thing. They would protect their turf.
Yeah.
You know, Air America, they were flying sometimes for aid and sometimes for military aid, sometimes mm-hmm. for the attachés, and most of the time for CIA. You know, you couldn't say that plane is working for one agency this day and another agency tomorrow. It was, especially when you're up in the remote areas.
They might have a spare IVSer in the back, too.
Yeah.
Who's know. Just hopping a ride.
That's right. And so, yeah, it was kind of many times blurred as far as those distinctions.
So given this, the fact that you knew that if you wrote a detailed report to AID, that some of the information could be passed along. Did you ever self-censor your report so as not to pass on something that might be too sensitive for people in your local area?
Any sensitive information we would only give verbally to someone who we trusted.
Okay. So it wouldn't have ever been anything that you would have put in any kind of report anyway.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. I was curious about that because all of these lines are blurring all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
And here was a monthly report that suddenly goes into Vientiane. And a volunteer who is naive might say something and then have it come back on somebody and they say, oh my gosh, what's going on here?
I was naive in the incident with Jam, the pet boar.
Yeah.
I knew exactly what I was doing. By the time the incident came up with the irrigation engineer, I knew exactly what I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that it would raise Holy King throughout the change of bureaucracy.
Mm-hmm.
But I wasn't getting any response otherwise. So
yeah. So there you were using the system.
We were using the system. And IBSers, we very soon learned how to do that. And other IBSers would tell us.
Even when you got there, it's part of your...
how we could manipulate the system.
Uh-huh.
And that's one of the advantages we had of being the bottom. And if you didn't have any plans of getting an aid job, you know, you could really tell the truth as you saw it, or you could manipulate the system and get things done. So, yes, the bureaucracy sometimes prevented you from doing things, but if you learn how to pull the right strings, you could use the bureaucracy to your advantage.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a career government service person, you would not have that luxury.
No, it would be an early end of a career.
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, I'm sorry to dwell on that, but I think that these are some important points.
I think
points.
It's important in relationship that IBS had with aid.
And yeah.
There was a certain dichotomy there that provided tension.
Yeah, it is murky at some point. And in fact, you know, here I've asked you about these monthly reports, and we're still in Hong Sa.
That's right.
But and this was a monthly report discussion that came off of the jam story,
uh-huh.
which was a spin-off of a listing of your activities as a volunteer in a work relationship. See, we can keep track of where we're going.
It's a little difficult at times.
It is difficult, but we can do it. So we've got the IRA for rice. We've got some animal husbandry, not only jam, but rabbits and all these other things.
Got involved in fish ponds also in Hong Sa.
And fish ponds, yeah. Uh-huh. That was also in Hong Sa.
Okay.
Anything else, or that pretty much cover it?
Got involved in refugee relief operations.
Again,
due to the fact that refugees, I had some refugees coming in, and then we were shipping the rice out.
Those refugees then, they were not the dependents of the military?
No, they were whole villages that came in.
Okay.
That we were taking care of. During the rice drops, we were flying primarily caribous. We had a longer airstrip that we could use caribous on. Think about 5,000-pound rice payload.
Uh-huh.
And I decided to go along and get some pictures. You know, I want a whole set of pictures of this. So I rode along on one of the drops, and I was a little naive. We got over the drop zone, and I knew that they pushed this rice to the back, and it kicked it out the back.
Mm-hmm.
And so these are transport types, planes with the troop seats on the side, and I was sitting there. So I unfastened my seatbelt and got up to take my picture. What I didn't know is when the pilot rang the bell and the kickers kicked it out, he also pulled the plane up.
Whoa!
And when he did that, I was slammed against the floor and I started sliding.
Out the back.
Out the back, and I was grabbing on and I hung on for dear life, and I thought he never was going to pull out of that climb.
Oh, geez. That
was the longest, probably 30, 15 seconds or whatever of my life.
Oh, wow. Could have been flying down with a rice sack in your arms all the way down.
Yeah, that would have been very embarrassing for IBS. I had to report this IBS or got kicked out with the rice, you know. So the next pass for the next load, I composed myself, and I remained in my seat with a seatbelt on, and I got my picture that time. First time I didn't get that picture.
No, you're lucky you still had the camera.
Second pass, yes, I am. And the second pass, where I stayed in the seatbelt, fun, and I got my picture okay.
About the kickers? How would they keep from falling out?
Well, they knew it was coming, and they would hang on. Oh, and they anticipated. It's just like, you know, I'd have been okay if I'd have known it was coming. But when things happen you don't anticipate, why that split second takes you to react, why you're putting a couple G's on you or whatever it was.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So they would kick, and would they also be holding on
They'd
to something
on.
While they're kicking?
They were holding on. They also had chutes on.
They had chutes just in case.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Because I know that some of the people who served in IVS at Don Duc told me that every once in a while one of their graduates would get a job with the military or AID, and they would come back and they'd say, oh, I'm a kicker.
Yeah.
You know.
Kicking rice.
And so I knew that they did this. I knew what they were doing, but I had never heard the story of how the operation went in its detail.
Now, this is jumping to Hong Sao, but we had an incident there. On a Pilatus Porter, you had a trap door that would allow the rice to go out. And the kicker there would be responsible for, like, putting two or three bags on this door. That's all they could hold and still release. They would drop the rice. The pilot make another turn around, bring the doors up, and the kicker would put the rice on there.
But he wouldn't kick. He just
no. He
put
just
the release.
The rice on.
Yeah.
And then the pilot would do the release.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
And Hui Sai, like I told you, they had an overnight station for the Air America pilots, and they didn't normally come up and work a 2-3 day rotation and go back to Bianchan. Mm-hmm. I was out at the airport, and they called in. This pilot called in, and what had happened? He was on a drop zone. He dropped his rice, closed the doors. He came around. The kick was putting the rice on. He got over and he dropped it again, and he didn't know the kicker was still there putting rice on, and the kicker went out.
Oh.
So he radioed back what happened. Joe Flipsy was in charge of operations there, and he told me. So I went in and got the guy's piece of luggage, came back out, and of course this kicker has his friends that are also doing the same job, you know, and they're at the airport. This guy landed the airplane, I pulled the door open, I shoved his bag in, closed the door, and he kicked it, and he took off. And we made sure that pilot was not assigned up there for 3-4 months, because the other kickers would have killed the pilot.
Really?
Yeah. So it was unsafe. We didn't even let that pilot get out of the plane.
So you just got the pilot's grip of materials, gave it to him, and...
Got his bag, luggage, and threw it in, and we took off.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Periodically, they would have that incident happen like that. A pilot didn't look close enough or such, you'd pull it, and the guy was bending over such, and you'd be right now.
Oh. He wouldn't be wearing a chute?
No. It's too close cramped quarters. And
That's pretty sad.
Yeah.
Yeah. And these supplies of rice were going to Hmong, mostly?
Mostly Hmong. Uh-huh. Now, in northeast Laos, it had a rich doorhouse of ethnic groups. I mean, it would be an anthropologist, absolute dream.
Oh yeah, no, it's a checkerboard
of just a fantastic diversity and such.
Yeah, every hill is a different group.
Yeah, it was quite an interesting area. Very colorful people.
Okay, but the refugees that you talked about just a moment ago, before we got off on this,
in Hong Kong.
They were actual refugees.
Yes, they were in the true sense of the word.
Uh huh.
Yeah, it was a whole village that came in.
And they were Hmong? Or some other minority group?
Yes, they were Hmong.
Okay. And this would have been in 68?
Yeah,
maybe
late,
early 69?
Late 68, early 69. Because one of the problems I had with them was the malaria. By living in the higher elevations, they did not have malaria problems. Hong Sao is kind of intermediate elevation.
Uh-huh.
And so they would have malaria problems. The local Laotian medics did not want to treat them. So many times I was treating refugees for malaria.
Uh-huh.
And I got to the place that I could immediately look at a person, immediately know if they have malaria or not. It was quinine sulfate you used to treat malaria with.
Uh-huh.
The only trick is that the curative dosage and the fatal dosage is
pretty close.
They're pretty close.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, I'm going to pause for a minute. Okay, we're off of pause now.
Okay, the one other cultural thing, I mean somewhat cultural, what you're used to, in Hong Sao was not at all unusual for the women to be topless.
Mm-hmm.
And this just became a norm.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember an Air America pilot came in, and we had a weekly plane. Of course, when the plane landed, that was a big deal for all the villagers and people come running. Well, on this particular day, the pilot came in. I got up into the cockpit to get her mail and such. And there was a Yao refugee woman, which was probably one of the most well-endowed women in all Southeast Asia. She was running towards the plane.
This particular woman?
Yes.
Not as a group?
Right. This particular woman.
Uh-huh.
She had a blouse on, but it was unbuttoned.
Uh-huh.
And so and no bra, so she was running down the plane, and she was flopping one side to the other. And this pilot looks up, and he sees her, and he says, "My God, look at that." Mm-hmm. I looked up and said, "Look at what?" He said, that. I said, "Well, what about it?" He grabbed my arm and says, "Son, you've been here too long. Let me get you out of here." But it, one of the things the Lao in their one-room villages, or one-room houses, there was, the children knew how babies were made. There was, mm-hmm. And it was just considered a part of life.
Uh-huh.
And I think maybe in some respects they had a much more healthier view of life and sex and such than what we do in the West, where we try to hide things and glamorize maybe the wrong aspects of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that certainly would come from something like that, you know. I find that also farm people have a much more matter-of-fact and healthy mm-hmm. perspective on things too, so that would go along with it. Yeah. Not only having one room,
right,
but that's also right. being able to see all the animals
of
and
the animals
to know of the cycles and
the birth
and things
and
like that.
And death.
And death, too. I mean, we hide that in the United States. I mean, you know, we have, death is something that discreetly happens in a hospital and we don't have to worry about. And we
sanitized.
Yeah, and the funeral is never in the home that's anymore, right. although it used to be. You know, we can, well, anyway, I don't want to get onto that too much. I know you're looking down a list of stuff, but...
better be getting out of home so I would never get through this tonight.
Yeah. your time in Hong Sa then went from when to when, just to get the chronology straight,
from about
July, August, or a little bit later?
No, it had been... probably late August.
Late August?
Until
okay.
the next February, March, I believe, something like that.
Okay, February.
I'm sorry, I'm awfully fuzzy on it.
Well, no, that's because this happened again, a second time. So things can get a little fuzzy. What I wanted to ask you about, which was a follow-up to the Hmong refugees that you began to take care of, mm-hmm. were they refugees because of the battles and activities that would eventually force you out? Was that an indication of how
yes.
things were
yes,
turning?
Yes, that was.
Because if they're coming to you by late December of 68 or early January, something like that of 69, that would seem to me that
yeah,
the battles are coming.
It was
close.
It was an indicator. Also in that and. Northwest part of Laos, the Chinese were building a road down
okay.
that area. And that was one of those interesting diplomatic trade-offs that everybody knew they was building it. And the trade-off was, for whatever reason, they were allowed to build a road if they wouldn't do such and such things. So there was a tit-for-tat type of deal.
Mm-hmm.
So they were pretty well left alone.
They weren't bombed at all. You mean, if that's what you mean. Okay, we're taking it back off pause. It's running again. Okay, so it's really these refugees that are an indication of what's about to come.
Right.
And because I asked you earlier what it was that motivated you to ask your chief of party to give the order for you to depart.
Right.
See, and when I asked you that, I wasn't clear about how long you had been there. I was thinking, well, maybe this guy has just arrived. He sees a couple of things, he panics, he calls.
No, this
calls
is just
over. But you're already there for
yeah,
quite a stretch.
Period of time.
You know what's going on.
He had quite a pattern.
Yeah.
It was interesting that when Jim Archer left, we had the colonel wanted to have a district officer, colonel wanted to have a going away party for him. And I was really nervous.
This is the Laotian?
Laotian, yeah.
Okay.
And they had a parachute they put up for a tent, lit the thing up, we were wide open, and there we were most of the night at this party.
Yeah.
And a very vulnerable situation to be in. and I could just see him, you know, picking us off.
Mm-hmm.
But what was interesting, at the Patalau radio then broadcast after Jim left that they had made a hit in Hong Sa and had killed him. And of course, he was gone.
Mm-hmm.
So it gave some credence to their report.
That's right. You couldn't bring him back?
No, we couldn't bring him back. He'd gone back to Canada for a leave,
right.
You know. And so this was part of the whole game that they would
play. And Archer was Canadian.
Archer was Canadian, right.
Okay.
Now, he did come back to Laos and had another tour later.
With but, IVS?
Yes.
Really? Okay.
But, you know, they were very sophisticated. I don't know if I mentioned on the tape about when we entered the country.
I was just remembering that that you mentioned that to me, and we got to get that on there.
Our IVS group, Lisa, I was told this. I never heard it directly, but we were told that the night before our new group arrived in country, that the Patalau broadcast all of our names in our hometowns, just to demonstrate their intelligence capability that that they had.
Just giving you a little bit of a warm welcome, even though you don't know about it.
Right.
So how would they have found out? They must have had people in Vientiane who knew people who
probably
were in the IVS office.
IVS office, aid office.
Yeah, and who were funneling information on a regular basis, even to the extent of hometowns.
Right. So they apparently got our files or something.
Yeah, or had people who could look at the file for stuff.
We had a situation in Hong Sa where we had another incident in Hong Sa in which we were picking up some Vietnamese on our radio. We had radios, single sideband radios. We make radio checks morning and night, and we had to be on time on that. And a lot of this for security purposes. So we missed a radio check, they'd send a plane to check on us. They always told us they would charge us the airtime for it.
Mm-hmm.
So we tried to be pretty faithful in that. Well, on our radio, we were hearing some Vietnamese language, and we had a carpenter, a Laotian carpenter, working for us on some projects from Van Chan. And he was listening to this, and he started translating for us. And it was like some military communication of Vietnamese, apparently up in Pak Bang, north area north of us, that we were concerned about some military action going on. And then we asked him how he knew Vietnamese. He said, well, he used to own a store in Van Chan between a couple of Vietnamese, and he heard them talking back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we found that a little hard to believe, and we got to checking, and it didn't check out, and so we were pretty well convinced that not only did he know Vietnamese for a different reason, but he was a good chance he was a spy. And so we had him moved out immediately.
And he was what again? He was your...
He was a carpenter, working on our projects.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And we were very suspicious that he might be a spy and be able to come up and knock on our door at night. And, you know, we'd answer the door, and you'd have a problem.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was always a security concern.
Even people around you.
Right.
Yeah.
I remember a little incident. We were visiting in the village, and some fellows came in, some soldiers, but they weren't regular Laotian soldiers, and we, of course, were very suspicious, and they had some Chinese rifles, and we were sitting around there, and of course, it was kind of tense and not knowing what it was, and I still think they were probably Patalau.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, we were very concerned and trying to see how we could extract ourselves from the situation. Why? I remember I was sitting over in a corner, and one of them went to light a cigarette.
Uh huh.
He struck a match. And sometimes irrational things go through your mind, but the match head came off that match and flew right towards me. There was this flaming match head coming to me. And I thought, oh my God, that's what a bullet looks like coming at you. Of course, you'd never
especially see. Especially from that guy.
From that guy, you know, I thought I was being shot, you know. Of course, obviously, you would never see it. But that was some of the tension we had at that time. You never knew for sure who you were dealing with.
No, absolutely not. So after the Bob Lovin order,
yes,
that gets you out, you move on to assignment number two, which was what?
Moncasee.
Okay.
After some waiting in Vientiane, I was assigned to Moncasee.
After how long in Vientiane?
Might have been a month.
Might have been, okay, all right.
I think I took a vacation then.
Oh, that's so right. You would have had vacation time coming.
So they get me reassigned. I took a vacation down into Cambodia, Singapore, and Bali.
Yeah.
Great time. I went to Moncasee. Lauren Willey was the IVSer there. Moncasee had a turbulent history. A few years before, there had been a Patalau attack at Moncasee, and Alex McIntosh was wounded in that time. And fortunately, he recovered, continued on with IBS. We did have a fatality there and a fellow that drowned in the river.
Murphy
happened at Moncasee. One of the theories that I picked up there that apparently there was some electric, high-powered electric eels in that river.
Oh, really?
Some of the villagers thought maybe that's what happened. I never saw many of those eels and can't confirm that. But they thought he might have been...
Who was the fellow who was wounded?
Alex McIntosh.
Oh, okay.
Excellent. In fact, he was staying in the upstairs of the restaurant where we ate our meals in the village. They had a room up
in
there
Moncasee.
At that time. In Moncasee, yeah. And that's where they were living. Then when I got there, the Bureau of Public Roads is building a road from Vientiane to Luang Prabang. And Moncasee was on that route. And Bureau of Public Roads built a house for IVS, a bamboo frame house, but then with the bamboo walls and such. And
how bad was he wounded?
I don't think any permanent injuries. He might have been the Clark for recuperation, Clark Air Force Base, but I'm not too sure on that.
Okay.
That was before I was in country, so I...
Yeah, no, I know that you're getting this as a secondhand thing. I was just interested because he did return his form. He is in Texas, teaching at the Department of Sociology in Texas A&M.
Oh, he is?
Yeah.
Okay.
And
he married a Laotian gal, too.
And so that's Bryant, Texas. And I'm not going to Texas, but Mark will be. So I'll pass along that little information that... That Alex certainly was very much involved and had actually gotten wounded in one engagement. I can remember this, I gotta write it down.
His Laotian assistant was killed in a grenade incident at a party.
At a party?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the... not only do you have to worry about the Patalau situation, but with the Laotian soldiers and everyone being armed with teeth and grenades, and you get Laotian get a little drunk and get jealous that someone's paying attention to his girlfriend. A lot of times they just roll a grenade under a table. And grenades are very indiscriminate in what they do. So that was another concern.
Let me write this note down and I'll pause in the meantime. There, I'm putting this back on again. I made my note to myself.
Just a little concern we had in Hong Sa, it kind of relates to modern or more recent happenings in this country. There was over 300 tons of fertilizer in our fertilizer shed that had been shipped in on Hong Sa on this original project.
Oh, geez. Yeah, okay.
And the...
That's almost a sick joke.
The nitrate smell...
Mm-hmm.
Was very strong in there, and we often wondered. I never did get a professional opinion. We often wondered what a mortar shell would do in that fertilizer.
Oh, it would have blown it sky high.
If we'd been able to detonate it.
Oh man!
If we had to detonate it, we would have been part of a crater, no doubt.
You and half the village.
So we were hoping that the Patalau didn't think of that. Because if they would have thought of that, that would have been awfully hard to resist.
Oh, geez. Yeah, just to see the Big Bang.
And when the Oklahoma Federal Building was blown up, of course, brought that back to mind.
Yeah.
The tremendous power just a little bit of that has.
Yeah, and there you were sitting on tons of it.
Yeah. More than you put in a truck.
More than you put in a truck. Wow, it's pretty sick.
Okay, Hongzhou.
Yeah.
I mean, Mokasi.
Yeah. Because how long were you there? This would have been, by the time you get there, it's already like April or something like that.
Yeah, right? Mokasi was only, I think, a couple months.
Yeah, and...
I should have gotten some chronologies laid out for you. I'm sorry.
Well, that's all right. We don't have to really be too precise, but just an idea to know your experience.
Yeah, it was a relatively short time.
Uh-huh.
Mokasi was kind of a focal point of North Vietnamese advance to the north and east of Mokasi. And in fact, it became international news. So we were kind of sitting in a untenable situation there. Also, mm-hmm. in the local situation, I was very concerned about security. And Lorne, as we were comparing notes later, did not pick up on some of the things that I did. And it really pointed out that when you live in an area, sometimes you get so close to the situation, you don't see the changes.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw reactions at the villagers and just very small body language things that told me that there was some difficulty in that area.
Just to clarify, because you did tell me about this a little bit earlier,
mm-hmm.
and you said that you and he went around together and you were talking with people, and... Obviously, you've already now been in the country long enough that you're beginning to pick up on the body language and the facial expressions. And apparently, you talked to a number of people and you picked up a few signals that something was wrong.
Right. Of the villagers, they start to withdraw just a little bit from you.
Yeah.
And starting to distance themselves. And this is the type
of... Not for personal reasons, but for something else.
No. And so this is the type of thing that I was picking up. Plus... some of the terrain and such, I realized it was very ideal ambush area.
Well, but it always would have been ideal ambush area.
And when you're in the area, it seemed like sometimes you go through some of these areas and there wouldn't be anybody around. And you know, I'm not sure if they just disappeared when you got there or they weren't there.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
That's one of the things you always want to look for.
Mm-hmm.
Mokasi was... Well, maybe a question. Go ahead.
No, I was only going to say that is this the place where there was also a working relationship with the Patalau?
Yes, the local Patalau. We were able to go into the main village during the day. Now we lived about I'd say 2-3 kilometers from the village, next to the military compound. It was about 300 feet from the military compound. And we'd go in a village and work the area during the day. At night, the Patalau would come in and visit their wives. And they'd have children all different ages. And I don't know if it was ever stated to anybody or negotiated, but it was just kind of an unwritten rule we had that we would stay out of the village during the night, and they would stay out during the day.
Mm-hmm.
And we coexisted.
Mm-hmm.
And so that served us pretty well. Where it would break down is when North Vietnamese would come in. And we had an incident that did indeed happen. The North Vietnamese came in and got within about 1 kilometer of our front porch about 4 or 5 o'clock one morning. They ran into a local military patrol and they wiped it out, but they made a lot of noise doing it.
So you knew that there was something happening real close.
Yeah, there was a firefight. And the colonel called us up on the field phone and told us he was sending a group of troops over to our house.
This is a Lao colonel?
Yeah. So to make sure that we didn't take any action. We did have weapons in the house.
Mm.
And we had sandbags around, and we had a bunker underneath the house. So the next morning, they had moved back, that group of North Vietnamese troops had moved back a ways, and the T-28s were coming in and bombing their positions, and we had a spotter plane, like his U.S. Air Force, but the guy was in with a spotter plane, and we was talking to him a little bit, trying to decide, you know, what the situation was. It's very difficult. But we were literally sitting on our front porch watching this take place. And so it was early afternoon. I finally turned to Lauren and I said, "Lauren, we can't stay. We got to go." And he says, "Yeah." He says, "I know you're right." And it was very hard for Lauren because he'd been there, I don't know, maybe a year.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd only been there a short time. And it is hard to leave an area. Hong Sao was hard to leave because I'd been there long enough. And that was difficult.
What was some of that difficulty?
Because you have gotten a working relationship, you've established friends, and you have shared risk with them.
Mm-hmm.
And you get very close to them, and you also know that when you leave, they can't.
Yeah.
And you spent, you know, a lot of time building up trust, whether it's personal or whatever nature.
Mm-hmm.
So that makes it hard to leave, because you know when you leave under those circumstances, you probably aren't going to come back.
Yeah.
So we said, yes, we're going to have to leave. And about that time, a C-123 came in with munitions for the local military colonel. We had radios we could talk to the planes with. So I got in a radio walkie-talkie with the pilot, and I told him, I said, "We're running evacuation. I want to hold you on the ground." And he said, "Well, I'm not holding for anybody. I'm taking off." I said, "Well, you need to do that, or I'll call operations down in Vanchon, and they can send you back." I said, we got a bunch of Thai people to get out, and we got some Americans to get out. And so I held him on the ground about a half hour. He was mad at all, you know. But he knew he'd get sent back if he took off. And we had some Thais working irrigation engineers. We got them on. Lauren went out that plane, and I met the payroll we had and went to saw the colonel. And I guess in hindsight, it's a little unusual. Lauren went out on that rather than I, and I'm not too sure what that reason was. Yeah, I'd only been there a couple months, and literally I took command of the situation. I still don't know for sure why Lauren allowed that. I'm the person that, if the situation presents itself, I will step up and,
mm-hmm.
and take command if needed. I'd have probably been a good soldier. It would have been for a conscientious objector.
Yeah, right.
But anyway, I did. I'll take it back. I did not meet the payroll that day. But I tied up some loose ends.
Mm-hmm.
And that plane went to Vanchon. And then I was flown to Bon Binh and stayed overnight there. We did not know the situation, we didn't know what we might be back. Colonel Hafner mm-hmm. came in on the plane that took me out. And he was gung-ho if there was going to be American presence in Mokasi. I mean, I guess there's a bunch of chickens, and he was going to demonstrate. Well, yeah, he made a horse's patoo of himself on that situation. But anyway, I went to Bon Binh. And mind you, this there was a lot of concern about us in Mokasi, and North Vietnamese got in close to us. And while this was going on, Dennis Mummer and Art Stillman were killed
mm-hmm.
In an ambush. We did not know it at that time. In fact, told you Lauren Willie was with Al Best, our administrative assistant in Vanchon, when Al Best got the call. And Lauren was concerned if the call was for me, because he didn't know for sure if I'd gotten out.
Mm-hmm.
The next morning, Bon Binh, Jim Gingrich, who was stationed in Bon Binh, came in the house with Bert Pukler, where I was staying as the aid coordinator. And he broke down and said that Dennis and Art had been killed.
Broke down?
Emotionally.
Okay.
Of course, it was rough for all of us because I had spent part of my orientation with Dennis, and then Art came real close to me because he was associate chief of party. At that time, it looked like the situation could see. We didn't know a whole lot more. And so Bert said he'd had a plane going up there. I could go up and check the situation out. So I flew up. At that point, I did make the payroll with the local fellows.
Mm-hmm.
My Lao assistant, Boon Mi, was with Kong Lei when he pulled his coup attempt in Vientiane.
You mean in 1960?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he had some fascinating stories about that. So he became very protective when I was up there, and he had
in Moncasi.
Moncasi, yeah.
Yeah.
So the time I was up there meeting payroll and such, he was going around with me with a machine gun on the whole bitch, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to see the colonel and to say my goodbyes because I...
This is the Lao colonel, not Colonel Hafner.
Right.
Okay.
Colonel Hafner left, and I don't know how he got out.
Oh, he
got an earlier plane out.
He realized that the IVS guys were not cowards and that they might have left for some real good reasons because he's gone too.
Anyway, so I went to see the colonel and tried to assess the situation. He said, no, it's not better. And he gave me the military briefing of what was going on. And I told him about Art, and he knew Art. And he was very sad on that. So then I left that day. And that's where I lost my letters from Deb. Deb sent me letters, and that's where I lost most of the letters because we made such a hasty retreat out of Moncasi that most of my personal effects I did not get out. So we went to, from there,
what happened to Moncasi after you left?
I really don't know if they had a change in administration there or not. I know the security got very bad.
Mm-hmm.
And a few days later, I was in Earl Young's office, who was the area coordinator for the area. And I asked Earl about the chances of going back in. He says, the only way you can go back in now is a parachute and all black at night, you know. He was exaggerating, but the security said there's no way we can go back in. And then he turned to me and he says, I'll let you read this report. He says, it's above your security clearance, but... He says, I'll let you read it anyway. And what he handed me was an intelligence report on a North Vietnamese military unit going to make an attack on Moncasi. And this report had all the details of their attack plan, had the names of the guy who was going to block the road to the south, or block the road to the south and the north, had the name of the guys going to command the groups coming in on our house, the whole bit. And they had this days before this incident happened, but it got tied up in bureaucracy and didn't get through. The blue smoke rolled out of my mouth, something fierce. I was livid.
Yeah.
And he just let me go and let me blow off steam. He says, I don't blame you. And it turned out that a friend of mine, Hui Sai, had heard about it, but he didn't think we were in there. He thought we'd pulled out. So it was a case of about the whole country knew about this but us. And that's, you know, so many times these bureaucracies broke down and the IVSers that there was intelligence out there that were in danger and they didn't get the word through, and that made us very angry, to say the least.
Oh, yeah.
And at times we didn't know if it was just the bureaucracy or at times they wanted us out there regardless. We really felt expendable.
Mm-hmm.
That maybe some of the people in Vientiane, whether they meant to or not, was really putting us at risk.
Absolutely.
And you'd hope it wasn't purposely.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe a lot of us that they didn't realize the situation, the significance of some of these intelligence reports. And of course, we had a great appreciation for them.
They who? The AID or IVS?
AID.
Mm-hmm.
So that, and then, of course, about this time, we did have a memorial for Art and Dennis. We had a loss earlier, and we'd met in the church their Protestant church in Vanchon, and they quoted Art Chandler Edwards monthly report, and he used a couple of dams in his monthly reports, and so we were then banded from being in that church. We couldn't have
But that's the fellow who was killed.
Yeah, that was it.
And you're just reading his report.
They're reading his report. And so I didn't have too much use for that. Well, I was a very avid churchgoer, and I attended church one time, the first Sunday I was in Vanchon, and I was so put off by it, I never attended church there again. So I think my spiritual journey was very significant, influenced by Laos.
Was this idiosyncratic to that one church, or is this reflective of something about the war?
It was a very conservative, fundamentalist church.
Oh, okay.
So we had the memorial service at a public type of thing. And I remember going to that service, and one of the weird things in Laos is they had a board going on the Path of Laos, but the Path of Laos still had an embassy in Vanchon.
Mm-hmm.
And their soldiers would drive around the streets in a jeep, and we came up behind that jeep. And I was hit, and I was so angry. To this day, I'm thankful I did not have a weapon. Even with my conscientious objector stance and such, I would have probably created a very terrible incident there if I had a weapon.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I got over it, but
because you knew Stillman pretty well.
Yes, and Dennis as well. How did you know them? Well, Dennis, I'd spent my orientation with him. I spent, actually, 3-4 days with him.
Oh, okay.
As far as my orientation.
When you first arrived in Laos.
And then Art Stillman was associate chief of party for part of the region I was in. And of course, I knew Art because he was on staff, and he was a type of individual that you really were drawn to because you knew he had a lot on the ball.
Mm-hmm.
You knew he was head and shoulders above the rest of the staff. Had a lot of respect for Art. Little side thing, and Chandler Edwards was killed when I was still in Hong Kong. And there's a really weird irony there because Deb, that summer, was at NIH, a normal patient plan, or normal patient program. Are you familiar with that? National Institutes of Health. They have college students come in and they do some medical research, do some drug studies and such.
Okay.
And the college students are the norm. They use them on a lot of these.
For high drug use?
No, for any kind of drug, not necessarily narcotics, but for different things. And Deb was on estrogens type of study.
Uh-huh.
And so she was plotting her cycles and all this stuff. While the girl that occupied the room next to her was Chandler Edwards' girlfriend.
Really? Oh, wow.
So that was, here again, these interconnections were just unbelievable. And that happened while he was killed.
How was he killed?
He was ambushed on the road.
Specific to him?
Yes.
How did people know that it was specific to him? Rather than just the first person by.
Well, he was. That was well known. You don't kill an American. He's the only American around.
Okay.
There was no mistaking. Dennis and Art were killed in an ambush. Dennis was apparently killed when the B-40 rocket hit the car at the jeep, exploding flames.
Uh-huh.
Art was not killed immediately. He was killed with a single gunshot wound to one eye.
Mm.
So we feel pretty sure he was interrogated by the Pathet Lao before he was killed.
Pathet Lao or North Vietnamese?
I don't know for sure.
Okay. Did they have some Laotians with them? Like their assistants or
now that I don't
staff?
Know.
Okay.
That I don't know. That's a little fuzzy on that.
Okay. Because someone recently that I spoke to talked about the mortar attack that killed a couple of IVSers plus Laotians, and I wasn't
there
sure.
There might have been someone. But my understanding that... that
it was Art, just the two of them?
Art was not killed in the initial attack on the rocket, but was killed after interrogation. But that might be wrong. It was hard for us to get information for sure on that.
Yeah. Yeah. But you told me one particular thing about him, that he had just resigned.
Yes, this we learned. We went, Lauren Will and I took the train down to Bangkok to attend a Buddhist service at Sumali, Art's widow, who was Thai, and she wanted to talk to us a little bit privately. And at that time, she told us that Art had already resigned. A lot of protests of staff. The background of that is after Bob Levin left, Walt Johnson became chief of party. Walt Johnson came from the educational side. IVSRD, Rural Development, was very unhappy with Johnson being in that position. We did not have confidence in him as a leader, and we did not feel that he represented us well to aid. We felt he was kiss-assing up to aid to try to further his own fortunes, whatever that might be. Also at this time, we were having really misgivings about Washington staff. Felt that they were trying to get sweetheart deals with aid and didn't realize the situation we were in. Because we were becoming very much the opinion that we were considered expendable and that the proper security precautions weren't being taken for us, especially on the part of the aid people.
So you were looking for strong leadership from IBS and in support, and didn't get it.
The only one we had strong leadership was Art Stillman. And so that was very revealing to us that, that he'd resigned. In fact, I'd forgotten that until I reviewed my journal just a few weeks ago. So of course, it was a very bittersweet background for some relief that he'd already resigned and then was killed. Art was a very brilliant fellow. I think he had a master's in Asian history. Family from Sugar Heights, Ohio. So we're completing. You running out, or?
I'm always checking.
Watching it,
When it's down towards the end, yeah.
Let's see. I'm trying to wrap up. Not to see.
Well, I thought you were going to say something more about Art. Okay, I thought you were on the